Welcome to another episode of Empower Her podcast, where we celebrate the achievements of women making a significant impact in affordable housing. Today, I'm joined by my co-host, Nicole Graham, co-CEO of CSG Advisors, and Millie Hurt, Vice President of the Women's Affordable Housing Network. Hello, ladies. How are we doing today?
Pretty good. Thank you.
I'm wonderful.
Great. Thank you, Millie, for joining us. We're excited to have you. Today, we're joined by someone that I have admired since I joined CSG 9 years ago. She was a force then and has become a bigger, badder, badass. We're delighted to welcome Celia Smoot.
Hi. Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon. Celia's career is a mosaic of dedication and leadership in addressing critical housing issues. Her impressive history includes key roles at organizations like the National Affordable Housing Trust and LISC, where she focused on affordable housing finance. Previous to that, Celia was also a lawyer for HUD for 10 years. At her current position as the SVP and head of fund investments at the Key Community Developer Corporation, Celia has been pivotal in driving innovative housing solutions, advocating for policies that support equitable and sustainable community development, and leading initiatives that make a real difference in people's lives.
We're just going to keep on the love fest because Celia was also recognized as one of 6 women investors by Forbes. It's totally amazing. And her work on community lending focused on underbanked communities is truly game-changing. With her extensive experience and commitment to positive change, Celia stands as a beacon of inspiration and guidance in the affordable housing sector. She exemplifies the power of determination and expertise in tackling some of the most challenging issues in our industry. It is an absolute honor to have you on our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. One thing I say about our industry, it's super small. No matter, once you're into housing, you may sit at different chairs at the closing table, right? You may be the developer, you may be the consultant, you may be the, in my case, the lawyer. You may be the investor, you may be the lender, but like you never leave, right? Once you're in, in the space, it gets into your bones and you never leave.
So you would know Lori Little then, my mentor.
Lori Little. She is like literally one of my favorite people on the entire planet. And talking about being a badass. Definitely a badass.
We have to do a little shout out for her because she really was the founders of the Ohio chapter. So personally, throw some love her way. Anyway, I'm so glad to meet you. I feel like I'm like starstruck now.
I appreciate it.
Cecilia, easiest question. We're going to start slow. Tell us your story. Like, how did you get here?
I always knew I would be a lawyer. I didn't know where that will take me, but I always knew I would be a lawyer. Plus, I was a lit major in college, so kind of had to go to law school because there wasn't a lot I was going to do besides sit around and talk about 19th century English poets. I mean, wasn't going to do that for the rest of my life. Although, obviously, I enjoyed it enough that I was part of my collegial education. So I did go to law school, and my first job out of law school was with HUD. So I was with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And I knew enough to be dangerous about what HUD does, but I worked in the Philadelphia HUD office. So basically I worked in the field office. I didn't work in headquarters, which means that I was actually doing actual transactions. I'm reviewing those transactions and talking about what we said before, once you get that bug, you kind of never leave the industry. And I just spent the next 10 years at HUD in private practice. I was at Hustle and Eloise. And just over that time, seeing all of the intricacies, what I call like the important little puzzle pieces of trying to meld real estate finance, regulatory compliance, and quite frankly, mission-oriented work into this pot that is what affordable housing is. It's one of the few areas, I think, a few industries where you can actually have in your heart a mission to address communities. And do it from the perspective of what are these different kind of regulatory pieces that need to be in place in order to achieve and create that type of housing? What is the financing that needs to be in place to create that type of housing? And so I spent that my first part of my career as a practicing attorney. And all through that time, I always had this sense of the why, right? So when you're the lawyer, you're really on the other part of the transaction. You're kind of just, you're in the ticket and the tie role. But I've always had this sense of the why and wanted to be more in the front part of trying to figure out ways to address affordable housing issues in communities. And I think that it was really drove me to my role at LISC. I was at LISC for 10 years as director of LISC Housing and really focused on housing finance. And when I started at LISC, now I was part of a small group of what I call the HUD nerds, right? We're just a small group of folks where every now and then there was some kind of like gnarly deal that had some HUD piece to it. And they're like, oh yeah, go ask those HUD people over there in that corner. And we would answer these random esoteric questions that really required me to kind of dive into like all these different kind of HUD regulations. But then as time went, that role shifted. And it shifted to what is the actual vehicle? What is the actual platform that can be created so that we could do more, meaning LISC? We can do more, we can create more opportunity, we can have more impact and do it within this structure, this environment of HUD financing, HUD regulatory, and low-income housing tax credits and other type of public sector dollars that can support that work. We talk a lot about some of the amazing work that LISC is doing today. A lot of that started from those earlier challenges that were placed in front of me, trying to say, what do we need to do to create a system and a program so that we can build a financing tool that allows nonprofits and that allows minority developers, that allows housing authorities to really be able to build and preserve housing in the communities that we care about, in the communities that LISC was in. And so that's where a lot of that kind of fund development, let's create a fund. Let's kind of figure out a way that we can accumulate all these different dollars, public sector dollars, the institutional dollars, foundation dollars. How do we put all of that into a bucket that really does support the ability to bring affordable units online and do it so that it's market responsive? And I did that for 10 years, and it was definitely a learning curve. You know, I come from being more of a lawyer to really having to think way more broadly and way more 20,000 feet up about how you make those things happen. And then it became more of a taking that and transitioning into my role at NAHT, which was more about like, how do we think about those broader things, but can we distill it in the space of low-income housing tax credits? We talked about Lori, and one thing I always appreciate from her was that she really wanted to address the challenges that are in our industry about how do we address barriers to entry for all.
Yes.
And
for all.
For right. all, right? We talk a lot about nonprofits today, some of the bigger nonprofit players. I think you guys had Priya at one point, who was an amazing, also a badass, and she runs an incredibly impactful and innovative nonprofit affordable housing developer. And there's a lot of organizations that have grown to that space, and which quite frankly, a lot of these nonprofit developers can compete against any for-profit developer in our industry. But it wasn't always like that. I mean, you think about why NAHT was created. NAHT was created to be a response to the fact that the market did not think nonprofits had the ability to be a good developer and be a good steward of investment dollars. And now those nonprofit developers that NAHT was created to support as a tax credit syndicator are now some of the most influential players in the market.
How ironic, because yeah. affordable housing is mission-driven.
Exactly.
And so the idea that the market didn't value the mission-driven purpose yeah. of the nonprofits in this space and prefer for-profit is like super fascinating. It yeah. is counterintuitive, actually.
Yes. So much bias, right? Oh, well, it's got to be private. I just want to say one thing, Celia, that mm-hmm. I'm struck by in your story. It's such a great example of couple things that you've already mentioned, right? You get into affordable housing and you're like there. But it also, I think it just highlights like how you can change roles. And I love how like you described your position when you were a lawyer, you felt like it was at that point more like ticking and tying, right? You were sort of beginning of your career, right? So that makes sense. And then to go from that to really being at the beginning and getting this much broader perspective and being able to see through that broader perspective, like, okay, here are the pain points. Here are the issues that are preventing the type of community development and the type of affordable housing that we're all sort of looking for. And to be able to like address, to your point, like the policy issues that are actually getting in the way of that. And I think for folks who might be listening who are at the earlier part of their career, right, I think it's just a great example of how each career is very individual. And you see something that might be, okay, like I like maybe this aspect of my job, but I really want to do this other thing. And like, here you are, you just completely transformed your career to be in this amazing space now. So it's very cool.
And I will say that even if you had asked me 10 years ago, did I ever see myself being at a bank? I would have told you, yeah, that's not in my future. And lo and behold, to all of our surprise and chagrin, here I am at KeyBank in this role, being the investor. And it's also different being in this side of the table. Guru, I said, you may have a different part of the seat at the closing table because now spending so many years, like the other half of my career, like first being a lawyer, then the other half of my career actually being the one trying to fundraise, being the one putting the actual apparatus together to now being the one who is the investor who invests and reviews those apparatuses that support affordable housing. It's very interesting. And I will say it's a different arc sometimes for me, but I also feel that the trajectory works. One of the values I think that this industry has is that in each role, you actually get to learn something new. When you get to a point where you don't feel like you're learning anything new, I think that overall you can feel stale and stuck, but this industry is so robust and is so layered that you can take on different roles, you can take on different parts, sit in a different seat, and then not only have a different impact, but you also can learn new things. I think that separates our industry from a lot of others.
We need non-bankers in banking roles because I'm sure that you bring that wealth of not only experience, but you probably bring that mission that sometimes they need. I say that as a now banker that never thought I'm still not a banker, but I would, you know, never thought I would be a banker either.
Yeah. I do think that I have added the nomenclature of impact more so than they thought that I would, but
I have more than they bargained for.
I'm willing to rise to that challenge to continue to do that. Yeah. So that's pretty much my story. Like I've been in the industry for over 20 years and started fresh eye, bushy tail, young lawyer at 25 at HUD. And from there, I never left. And quite frankly, I don't ever see myself leaving the industry because it's the thing. Like once it's in your blood, it's in your blood and you never leave it.
No, I agree. I'm never leaving. Mm-hmm. Totally agree. It's amazing. So can you talk a little bit about your latest investments into fund sponsors?
Yeah.
So let's dig in a little bit to like what you do on a day-to-day basis. So I find this completely fascinating. Nicole and I are oftentimes on the developer side because housing authorities are often developers, right?
Yeah.
And so working at National Affordable Housing Trust and being on that side where you're trying to provide access to all resonates so much because we have a stake in that. And I think housing authorities, as they're transitioning their assets, really have a hard uphill battle to prove that they belong in the space. So from minority developers, new developers, right? It's all the same kind of story. And I really applaud your efforts in trying to balance that. And so how have you kind of done that with the work that you're doing now, which is totally different, by the way? Right? Because you're actually, you're raising money and then also distributing money, right?
Yes.
You do both.
So it's an interesting bit. So I'll focus on this actual investor role. I always find that like, it's interesting to see how the sausage gets made on this side of the table versus when I was actually raising capital. So that was, and so I'm like, oh, now I see. now I get why I got that response versus that response, right?
Yeah.
And other things that you have to balance when you're the investor versus actually when you're in a different role. Just to kind of back up a little bit, the role is make an investment to anything that which there is a fund sponsor. So KeyBank invests in low-income housing tax credit funds, multi and prop. We're mostly a multi-investor. For those of you who may be listening, that means the difference between like we're just a single investor in a fund with a syndicator like National Equity Fund or National Affordable Housing Trust versus a multi-fund in which we are one investor among many in a fund that's managed by any of the 35 to 40 low-income housing tax credit investors in our industry. We also invest in preservation and workforce funds, right? The idea that obviously we want to make sure that we're preserving the housing that we're building. And we also want to address housing for the missing middle. We want to have a holistic response to the affordable housing needs throughout the striations of AMIs. And we also invest into certain kind of community facilities. We've invested into a charter school fund. We invest in SBICs, which are small business investment companies. Now, as you clearly have been hearing, I am a housing person. I am definitely a housing woman. And I am focused my entire career on housing. And I know a whole lot about that. I don't even pretend to act like I'm an expert in the small business space, but there is a person who works on my team, Lisa Katula, who is definitely an expert and she's amazing. And I am so thankful to have her on my team. But one thing I will always say, like, hey, that's like a weird mix. You do a lot of this housing stuff, but then you have this outlier of this small business space. And it was a term that we kind of coined at LISC was that reason why small business is important, and especially when it connectivity to housing, is that housing is where a small business goes to sleep. Small business owners live in the same communities that the affordable housing is sited at. Small business owners are more likely to hire and employ people from the community. If you want to have a true comprehensive and holistic response to the community's needs, yes, you need to do the bricks and mortars. You need to do the housing part of it, but you also got to invest in the other things. The small business, how does that help and improve overall communities? How are you working with your public sector partners around the other kind of neighborhood enhancements that are necessary for people to have real community? Yeah, right?
That makes so much sense, right? It's like how for successful housing and community development, you need your small retail and your grocery stores, and you need access to healthcare services and education programs for your school. Mm-hmm. And you're right, like those small businesses are a completely vital part of that as well.
KeyBank also has what you call a very specific CDFI partnership. So we've set up a whole program around partnering with CDFIs. And I think that that is another way that we kind of, you know, provide capital to CDFIs that also then provides capital to organizations that not just housing, but small business, addressing food deserts, all of those things that are necessary for really building community. And so we try to figure out like how do we have the most comprehensive response and what levers that need to be pulled from a capital perspective or from an investment perspective from a bank like ours, who actually has a very wide footprint. How do we have the most response we can have that has the most impact in those communities? And so I actually think that whereas it seems to be like maybe disconnected pieces, when you really think about it, it all is very, very connected. And I've also been known to say quite a bit that even the housing that we invest in, we do treat it as more than a spreadsheet. This is very important to me that we realize that every deal that we look at, every deal that we finance and invest in, there are people on the other end of that spreadsheet. You make credit and investment decisions, obviously, right? You won't be able to continue doing this business if you're making bad decisions. But those decisions are more than just the numbers on the spreadsheet. There's families, there's futures, there's hopes of people in the communities at the other end of that. And keeping that as close to you as you're doing this work helps you stay grounded into really why we're all doing this, even if you're at a bank.
I know, I just got goosebumps. I just love what you just said. We should like put that on a coffee mug. There's hopes, there's futures, there's families.
Yeah.
And that's why we do this, right? I think that's why we're in this industry, right? So I'm going to jump to we have commiserated many times about how we stand out in a crowd because mm-hmm. every time I see you, it is very obvious that you and I belong together.
Yeah.
Right. And I know that there are some perceived biases out there. Mm-hmm. I was curious if you would be willing to share some of your very funny stories, because yes. I know that you are the queen of like, oh my God, you're never going to believe what happens. And I'm like, tell me everything. And I think for our listeners, right, like being a woman in this industry is small. Shout out to Juan and how amazing just the infrastructure is that we're trying to build. I definitely feel much more comfortable calling it out mm-hmm. because it exists and it's real. And I kind of want our listeners to get a little bit of a flavor for it.
Yeah. So one day I told somebody, I was like, yeah, there's not a state housing conference in this country where I can't walk into the room and know about 75% of the people in the room. And I say, well, a lot of that comes from during my time that I literally was the panel queen. I was invited to speak on everybody's panel. It was like by like maybe like the second year of it that I realized, I was like, oh, I know why. Because what was happening, especially in the finance area, there wasn't a lot of us, especially on a lot of minority women, who were basically available to speak on panels around affordable housing finance issues, right? And I realized what was happening is like, it'll be all three white guys and me. I actually was talking to someone one day and we were talking about that. He was like, oh yeah. He's like, yeah, they were looking at the panel like, oh man, you know, this panel is three white guys.
At least they started to notice.
And basically what would happen. And so because of that, I was always on this panel circuit because, oh, I can actually substantially speak about affordable housing finance in very specific ways. But the other benefit was, I didn't look like the rest of the panelists.
Right. I mean, in fairness, you are a ball and bundle of energy, which yeah. I appreciate. Yeah. And on a panel, you need that because the topic itself is dense. So yeah. maybe we give people the benefit of the doubt. And we say awesome. It's because you're awesome. Right. And it just happened. I mean, like when I first started at CSG, I realized that I was like in brochures. I didn't mm-hmm. realize that I was in the brochures yeah. until people started getting the promos and sending mm-hmm. them to me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I am in all of these brochures. Like it was yes. astonishing for conferences, yeah, yeah. for conferences, yes. because like they take your picture when you're there. I yeah. happened to be going a bunch of them and I just ended up in their brochures. I was like, hey, look at me. I look great. But it also was like, oh, I get it. Right. Yeah. Like to your yeah. point.
So ladies, I wanted to like just stop for a second because Women's Affordable Housing Network has actually come up with a fix, hopefully, for this issue. We just created and launched She Speaks, which is a registry of qualified yeah. women around the country on all of the topics in affordable housing. So now there's like a menu.
A menu of women.
Hopefully we can spread it out. And I will say that at least they're noticing now.
No, I think that's great. And I will say that I was on a panel at AHIC about 2 years ago, and the discussion came up about diversity and inclusion within our industry overall. And a lot of folks were feeling really, really good. And I was like, I don't want to be the Debbie Downer here, but let's do a numbers check. So I said, how many syndicators there are? There was some debate. Is it 35 or is it 40? And I said, and out of those 35 or 40 syndicators, how many of them are run by women? And then we realized that we start counting in the room, like there's maybe three or four at max.
Look at yeah. their board of directors and it gets you like the picture is not good.
Yeah. So the organization, you know, Emily is absolutely fantastic. When we're talking about just like syndicators overall, like who is a major player within our industry, out of those 35 or 40, maybe three or four of them are run by women or led by women. Then I start going to every other part of our industry. Okay, the executive directors of the housing finance agencies, right? So there was a yep. woman in the room who was from one of the housing finance agencies that I said to her, I was like, oh, I said, when you're at the ED meeting, how many women do you think are in the room? And her response was, oh, they're only allowing me to be acting. So I have not gone to, I didn't go to the ED meeting. And I couldn't have scripted it better. But like,
No, of course, because that's the point. That is the point. My mind is blown right here.
Yeah, maybe that number is 25%. And maybe 25% of the executive directors in the room, you know, there's an ED-only meeting at Housing Credit Connect, and maybe 25% of them are women. And then I said, okay, think about all the major developers, right? We can do for-profits, we can do nonprofits. I will say the nonprofit space, and a lot of those nonprofit affordable housing developers are badasses. And now you're seeing more women leading those organizations. Right. But think about it overall, the affordable housing developer constituency, how many of them are actually run by women? And I think the number is probably de minimis, maybe 5%. And then just keep going. Like, what are the parts of our industry where there's these cylinders? Like, I think about the tax credit investment shops between the institutional banks like us or some of the economic investors. And then the question of how many of those are run by women. You know, the person who runs our equity shop is Stacey Neckes. And actually, KeyBank is one of the few banks in the entire country where the entire equity management team are all women. And that does not happen in our industry.
They have a history of that, right? And that's not a new thing either.
So Christina Knuckles, who runs up our fund management, Victoria O'Brien heads up our acquisitions team. So I said, now, we've kind of gone through this discussion of every true player in our industry. And I've asked you how many are women by women, and we're like looking at those numbers. And I said, okay, now let's do this entire exercise. And then let's say what percentage of them are actually led by a minority person. So between women and minority leading any of those different sectors, the percentages aren't great. And when we go to these conferences, yes, we are seeing more Black and brown faces, more women in the room. And that is absolutely great. And I think that is fantastic. But the leadership roles, the actual influence roles, there's still work to be done.
That's the opportunity gap, right? So even if we can get equal pay and all the other things that we want, those leadership roles, like you said, are just still not available.
Yeah, so I got work to do. How about this? Like, we can be excited for the strides that we've made, but let's not sit on our laurels. Let's keep working at it.
Right. So how have all of these experiences driven how you show up? Because I think that not only is there sort of a gap in the leadership, but I do think that there's also a gap in the folks that are coming up and having new, fresh, young folks in affordable housing. So what are some things that you can kind of suggest that you potentially have done in your career with like mentoring, fostering new generations, or even kind of like succession planning?
Or even like, what were the most impactful things for you? Like, did you have someone who really like helped you through, or what works?
So I've had like some really key people in my career that helped me kind of think about and frame things for me in a way so that I can really see like there is space for me here. There is a role for me in this industry, and that I can have greater impact in those roles. And I will say, interestingly enough, some of the first initial people that have been most influential have been like, I had a partner at one of the law firms I worked with. It was a white male partner, the law firm at the time. Funny enough, most of the associates were all women. Both of the principal partners were both men. And I think I was the only person of color of the lawyers on staff. And it's not that long ago. I mean, given it was like in the 2000s, but it, like, it's
no, it's astonishing every time. Like, you hear it and you're like, really? Like, I think you're right. Like, we think we've made more progress than we have.
But he, one of the things he told me, he gave, he's like, you know, you have this curiosity about the why. I was just doing ticking and tying, you know, but I was always like, but why? Why are we why did the client want to do it this way versus this way? What's behind the decisioning of things? And he's like, never lose that curiosity. He's like, he basically said, that's where you're going to have your success. It's something about being a lawyer who actually thinks about the why and not just focus on the ticket and the tying. He's like, it's going to be something important to you. And I don't want you to lose that. And so given, I kept practicing, but I had that in my head every time, you know, when I made a decision to stop practicing and move and go to LISC and move into that side of the table, so to speak, they keep using that analogy. I had his voice in my head saying, like, don't lose the why. And for me, that was probably one of the first major things. The second major thing is that I had folks in my career on the housing finance side, like, there weren't a lot of women. I always say this, that, you know, at one point in our industry, basically women, especially on the tax credit side, asset management, But there's nothing wrong with being an asset manager. I think that that's a very important part of our industry that needs to happen. But you will find that a lot of women, especially the minority women, were all pushed into asset management roles as though like, okay, you can go out to the sites and deal with compliance stuff, but you're not the person we let talk to the investor. You're not the person we let talk to the actual developer client. And I don't know if that was just became a part of practice and it became intentional, but like the idea of what time I was really looking for other leaders to actually learn and gather a sense of purpose in our industry from, it was few and far between. There's Anika Goss Foster who runs Detroit Futures, and she was a PVP, a program vice president at Lisk while I was there. And I was just absolutely in awe of her. She's a Black woman who truly, really was grounded in the work and understood it from a perspective of not only what does it take to actually do something impactful in a community, but just navigating the politics of our industry where there were so little of the women at decisioning positions and decisioning roles. And I think that that was very helpful for me to like experience her mentorship, but also watching her navigate and understanding like what it takes to navigate in that world. Like me, like I was always like, I had the brains about the substance of it, all the other things that goes into being the only one in the room, that takes a different skill set. And I think it's a skill set that you have to learn. And it's wonderful if you can have someone who helps you navigate through that kind of complication of being the sole one in the room. That I know that probably all of us experience at one time or another, you know, being the only woman in the room, being the only person of color in the room, like, you know, we've all kind of experienced that at one time or another.
I was just going to say about the ally that we at WAN, especially we have like an ally committee, we have to have those allies and sort of recognize that person. And, you know, I think you were always, oh, I had some female mentor, and it sounds like you also did. And, but that's not always the case. And so.
Yeah, exactly. I will say that one of the reasons why I actually ended up going to NHT and what was my decision, and when it was that time for me kind of look for other opportunities, and the other opportunities kind of came to me, and I was talking to someone else and I was kind of going back and forth about it. And I remember my mother going to me, it was like, why are you taking, you know, so this is another offer. And I kept having this conversation with this man, and my mother was like, why do you keep talking to that man? You know, you're going to take the job with Lori. And it was because of the way when I described Lori Little, who runs NAHT, to my mother, she could hear my voice. What it was something that I probably had never experienced. My first conversation with her was, we as women have to really understand and own our value. And she's like, not even if you don't come work at NAHT. I want to make sure that you understand, looking at your career and your experiences, really understand what your value is and own that. And I've never had anyone say that out loud.
I love that so much for everybody. I mean, and what a wonderful note to end our time together, Celia, is this idea that people inspire us and they remind us who we are, and it actually makes us better. And that, like, to me is such a good demonstration of that. So I just want to say kind of thank you to my co-host. Thank you to you, Celia, for joining us. But also, before we go, I have to ask you your favorite food. And Nicole always clarifies, not just like what you like to eat, but like you're on a deserted island. If you only had like one thing.
I think my latest vacation may be influencing this a bit, but honestly, I could probably eat my weight in ramen. But I could, yes. I could never get tired of it.
You and my children. You have like different types of ramen, all different assorted, different broths, different the whole thing.
Thank you.
I'm hungry. Pregnant lady over here is now hungry.
Well, I mean, again, Celia, thank you. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Millie. And this concludes another amazing episode of Empower.